Hi, our main speaker is Christopher from Portland.
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's February 5th, 1987, and my home group is the West Portland group. I want to thank Mike for asking me to do this. I don't know if anybody will get anything out of anything I have to say, but I know that when I share my experience with the idea that it may help someone, I get something from it. It enlarges my spiritual life, so for that I'm grateful. A little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I started drinking at a very early age, and I had drank for about 11 years. And for whatever reason, my disease progressed very rapidly. In those 11 years, I was arrested 15 or 16 times for alcohol-related arrests. I went to two treatment centers, was in detoxes, hospitalized for alcohol withdrawal. I was somebody that was a daily drinker most of my drinking career and ended up becoming a daily oblivion drinker. I was a blackout drinker. Somebody that, at the end, started wetting the bed on a regular basis. And just to give you guys an idea of where my head can still go today, a couple years ago, I was speaking at a meeting, and before I came in, I was standing outside and kind of preparing on how I was going to start off, and I thought, well, I'll give the kind of the highlights or the lowlights of my drinking. And so I was, okay, 15 or 16 alcohol-related arrests, three DUIs, wet the bed on a regular basis, daily oblivion drinking, no job. Went through that series of things, and at the very end of it, a little voice in my head said, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. And I recoiled from that thought as if from a hot flame. However, I got to tell you guys that there was a time in my life that was the exact sort of thought that would take me to my next drink. That insanity that precedes the first drink. Some little, you know, looking back in hindsight, kind of, it seems goofy, but at the time, before, you know, when I was untreated, I would believe that stuff, and I would take it, and it would make total sense. Yeah, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, and I'd be drinking. But as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that thought in and out without any damage. Those things, however, don't necessarily make me an alcoholic, I believe. They are probably a pretty good indication, but what I believe makes me an alcoholic is that all my life I was somebody that was very uncomfortable in my own skin. I was somebody that felt different than, alienated from, apart from. I had anxiety when there was nothing to have anxiety over. I was terrified of people. I was somebody that if I was walking down the street and there was somebody coming on the same side of the sidewalk as me, I would cross the street so I could avoid eye contact with those people. I was hypersensitive. I was hyper self-conscious. I was somebody like if I was to walk down a boulevard in front of restaurants, I could actually hear the people in the restaurants judging me. Now, that was my reaction to life when I didn't have alcohol in my system. When I had a certain amount of alcohol in my system, I got relief from that. 10 drinks was my magic number. 10 drinks made me feel like how I thought you people felt normally, or not you people, but those people out there, how they felt normally. And the truth is that if I could have maintained what those 10 drinks did for me, I never would have came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I have that phenomenon of craving that after I get a certain amount of alcohol in my system, I lose control. And early on, I lose control occasionally or periodically, and then at the end, I lost control every time I drank. And right off the bat, drinking started causing me problems. I wrecked my first car at the age of 14, ran away from home. I was a runaway many times throughout my early years. I went to a private college prep school where we drank a lot like how colleges drink. We would, we'd have kegs on Thursdays, Fridays afternoon, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday morning. And I lost control right from the very beginning. I remember at age 16, the night that I specifically remember that and recognizing there's something wrong with the way I drank. My mantra also was, when I wasn't drinking, was that there's something wrong with me. I had that, not only did I have that sense of impending doom that we talk about, but I had this sense of impending insanity. I was always questioning my sanity. In fact, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I had two problems. I thought that I was an alcoholic, and my secret is that I was crazy. What I found out, however, is that that is alcoholism. You know, I've heard said that if drinking's my problem, that I'm not an alcoholic. And, you know, drinking didn't cause my alcoholism. My alcoholism caused my drinking. Anyway, what finally happened is in the fall of 1985, I stepped over an invisible line where I became a daily oblivion drinker. And for the first 3 weeks after crossing over that line, I drank to blackout every night. And at the end of the 3 weeks, I remember having a conversation with myself and thinking, my God, am I ever going to be able to stop this? And it was replaced instantly with, I don't care. This is the happiest I've ever been. And I've heard that alcoholism is the only fatal progressive disease that has a fun phase. And that was my fun phase. No job, no responsibilities, and just drinking around the clock. And after a couple months of that type of drinking, once again, I was trying to control it. I'd been trying to quit or control my drinking for several years prior to that point, or a couple years prior to that point. And again, I was on that roller coaster of trying to, you know, stop. And my days would consist of coming to in the morning. I would have the shakes really bad. I'd put myself together. I didn't have the external shakes where you could see somebody shaking like that, like I'm shaking right now. But I'd have these internal shakes, like these tremors on the inside, where I would always have my arms crossed, and I'd just coming apart on the inside. And I'd pieced together the night before, and I'd be filled with guilt, shame, and remorse, which was something that I'd lived with for, you know, for most of my drinking career. And I'd come up with a strategy on how that wasn't going to happen again, how I was either done with alcohol or how I was going to drink successfully. And somewhere, you know, later in the day, you know, that I would just either it would be the strategy, the light bulb would go off, and I'd have, okay, if I only drink, you know, this way tonight, then I'll be okay. And I would buy it hook, line, and sinker and start drinking, and I did it day in and day out, day in and day out. And it didn't matter whether it was, you know, I had done some sort of pitiful or incomprehensible, demoralizing thing the night before, or if it was just a blackout, you know, drinking the night before. Every morning that last year and a half, I woke up that way. And every day I drank again. In June of 1986, I did come to one morning after a night of one of those mornings like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that type of morning. And I was living in a little town in southern Oregon called Ashland. And I'm originally from Portland, and I knew I needed to get off alcohol. And so, and I was scared that I would go into full-blown DTs if I just quit. So my plan was is to wean myself off. So I went out on the freeway and I hitchhiked up to Portland. And the first night I drank 5 or 6 beers. Second night I drank 3 or 4 beers. Third night I went cold turkey. And on that third night I just started going crazy. My mind was racing, my heart was palpitating, I was sweating, I was shaking, and I just felt like I was coming apart. Anyway, I ended up in a detox, checked into a detox where they filled me full of Librium and checked my blood pressure around the clock for 5 days. And this detox was attached to a 28-day inpatient treatment center. And in this detox, there were other guys that were coming into the detox that were like seeing snakes come out of the wall, and you know, they were like 60, 70 years old, and had been drinking, you know, for 40 years. And they were being ejected into the treatment center after 3 days, and I was still there on the fourth day and the fifth day. And I suddenly knew what this treatment center was trying to do, that there was some sort of conspiracy going on to hold me in the detox longer than I really needed in order to make me think that I was worse than I really was. And then on the fifth day, the staff physician had given me a physical and had taken me aside and said, you know, that I had, you know, this liver damage and that I was probably about 5 years away from full-blown cirrhosis if I continued to drink. Definitely have full-blown cirrhosis within 10 years. And I knew exactly what was happening. This was like in a car lot, a closer, where they come in and say, you know, they give you the pitch and then have you sign the paperwork. So I wasn't really prepared to stop drinking at that time in the fashion that they wanted me to. All I wanted to do was detox, get off of alcohol, and put this whole alcohol thing behind me and get on with the rest of my life. And I ended up staying in for the 28 days, and I got out of the treatment center, and 2 weeks later I was drinking again. And yeah, because I didn't do anything. I didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't, you know, do any of the suggestions of this program. I really just tried to do it on my own, and I was convinced if I could get through the physical withdrawal, I could do this on my own. I ended up soon after that up in Alaska. I saw an article in the news or an ad in a newspaper that had a dry logging camp. It was an hour and a half float plane ride from Ketchikan, and it was dry. No liquor allowed, and the closest bar or liquor was an hour and a half away by plane. So I went up there, and I worked, and 3 weeks into the job, you know, everything was going fine until two guys showed up with a bottle of whiskey. And they said, you know, would you like a drink? And very quickly my mind said, well, it's been 3 weeks, I haven't craved alcohol, I haven't had withdrawal, I haven't gone through DTs, I'm probably not really an alcoholic, yes. And I took the bottle, and I tipped it up, and I went, dunk, 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 dunk. And they grabbed it and took it from me, and they said, hey, we got to make this last. I thought we were going to drink the fifth, you know. And what happened is that I ended up with about three or four shots of this whiskey or whatever it was that they had, and no other liquor. And I was an hour and a half away from the nearest liquor, and the next plane was until the next morning. And that phenomenon of craving came over me, and I laid in my bunk that night with like an itch that I couldn't scratch. I needed booze so badly. I mean, it was just coming. I was coming apart. I needed it. So next morning, I caught a float plane into Ketchikan, and there was a bar there in Ketchikan. And this starts a series of coincidences in my life that led me to Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's this bar in Ketchikan called the Fo'c'sle, and the Fo'c'sle was a place where all the loggers and the fishermen would come together and drink and fight and stab each other. It was a legendary bar, and. I went into this bar, and I went in with this guy named Dan, who from camp, who was, you know, one of the nicest guys in the world, and until he had about five drinks or four drinks in him, and he turned to me and he said, you think you're pretty badass, don't you? And the night just erupted from there. I ended up in jail, and you know, just to give you guys an idea of how delusional I was becoming too, I was in and out of a blackout. I was also a cop fighter. And I took a pretty good beating from the Ketchikan Police Department on the way there. And they threw me into a holding cell with two other guys. Because I was fighting, they just threw me in naked and then threw my orange jumpsuit behind me. And I had a quick alcoholic idea, which was to make sure that nobody messed with me, instead of putting my jumpsuit on, I went over and I punched the wall and then dropped to the floor and did 25 push-ups naked. And then put my orange jumpsuit on. And I remember thinking that throughout this jail that I was going to be known as this guy, you know, this badass that came into jail and, you know, you don't want to mess with him. And the reality is that it's like this idiot came in, you know, naked and punched the wall. But I passed out, and in the morning when I came to, the guy on the top bunk was hanging over the top bunk looking at me. And I said, you know, I said, can I help you? And he said, he goes, my name is such and such. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got 30 days sober. And I'm in here doing 10 days of jail time because I owe an amends, and my sponsor's in here making me do it. And I remember looking at him and thinking, my God, I can't even get away from these AAs in here. But anyway, from there, they took me to court, and I got on a plane later that day, and I remember as I was leaving Ketchikan, as the plane was taken off, not once did I think about alcohol being the problem. I thought, I will never come to Alaska again. You know? And that's just the way my disease, you know, worked in my mind. I came back down to Portland and then ultimately ended up back down in Ashland. I owed 8 days of jail time for my third DUI. I was doing the jail time on weekends. I would come in on Friday night and leave on Sundays. And between the third and the fourth weekend, I was arrested in Ashland on a Wednesday. And the police down there knew me, you know, on a real regular basis by now. And they took me aside and they said, you know, Mr. Clark, they said, you've got a hell of a drinking problem. You've got to do something about your drinking. Go see this guy, Joe Fisher. He's an expert on alcoholism. And, you know, he can help you out. And I was like, yeah, yeah, right, you know, whatever. And anyway, the next day I was walking down the street and there was one of these sidewalk preachers that had a, you know, Bible, and he'd read scripture to anybody that would come by. And he read something as I came by, and I have no idea what it was, but somehow it correlated with what the police had said about going and seeing this guy, Joe Fisher. And I took a few steps and I thought, now if I was one of those AA people, I would say, oh, there's no coincidences, and this is, you know, a higher power at work, and, you know, fate. And I took a few more steps and I thought, you know, what if for once in my life I didn't dismiss that stuff as being trivial and stupid and actually acted on it? And almost out of my own amusement, I turned around and went out and acted on it. And I went up to see this guy, Joe Fisher. And initially, he wouldn't see me because he knew who I was until I told the secretary that I wanted help with drinking. And she said he'd be right with me. And I remember as I was headed into his office, I was thinking, please not Alcoholics Anonymous. Please not AA. Hopefully he'd been through aversion therapy, 10 days, a couple two-day follow-ups. Now he's got 5 years and a wonderful life. But that wasn't the case. I went in, I sat down, and Joe did what we do, and he told me his story, a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And at the end, invited me to a meeting. Now, I did not want to go to the meeting, but I had a sense of obligation where I felt that I, should go, since I did ask him for help. And he took me to the Clay Street meeting of Ashland, Oregon that night, and got in there, and I introduced myself in the back, and I introduced myself as a newcomer, I knew you were supposed to. And the speaker told a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now, and then there's participation, and each one of the participants shared a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to identify. I said that, I drank like that. I thought like that. I felt like that. And there was this one guy who stood up and he shared that he had come out of a blackout holding a revolver in his mouth, and then he'd come to the next morning on the floor with the revolver next to him. And that gave me goosebumps because I had almost the exact same story. I had come out of a blackout and was holding a carving knife to myself, and it went back into the blackout and came to the next morning with the, on the floor with the carving knife on the floor next to me. The only difference between his story and my story is that I, somewhere in the middle of the night, knifed all the furniture to death. But that was very important because I thought I was the only person in the world that did this kind of stuff. And here was somebody else who was doing the same sort of things that I was, and he was staying sober. And I came out of that meeting with a sense of hope for the first time. And the next day, I did not take a drink, which was miraculous. I was somebody who lived with an obsession to drink on a daily basis, and I didn't drink the entire next day. And I did drink again after that because I didn't keep coming back. And finally, what happened is about a week later, on February 4th, 1987, I went out one more time to prove that I could control and enjoy my drinking. And my plan was is I was going to drink 10 drinks that night, cut it off at about 10 or 11 o'clock, come home, go to bed, get up the next morning, and be like a regular person. And the guy that was supposed to pick me up and take me to the bars was late, and I drank 9 beers in my living room, sitting there waiting for him to pick me up. So I kind of already blew my plan before we even headed out. I ended up down at one bar. I remember drinking vodka Collins that night, and I had one hand over one eye because I was seeing devil. And then I went into a blackout, and I came out of the blackout at a bar called Cook's Tavern, which was my favorite drinking establishment. And I was in the middle of securing a job as a bartender at Cook's Tavern from the bartender, this guy named Cliff. And it seemed as though I was a shoo-in for the job. And I remember thinking, that's going to be the solution. I can drink, work, drink, go to bed, come back to work, drink, And within a short time after that, Cliff had cut me off. Now, this is the kind of bar where they don't cut you off for drinking. And so this guy that was going to give me the job, I then yanked across the bar and was going to work him over on the bar, but he kind of weaseled his way away from me and ran into the walk-in refrigerator and called the cops from inside the refrigerator. There was a phone in there. And I ended up running through people's backyards, with the cops chasing me, and finally they caught up with me. This on February 4th, that night of drinking was not a real significant event in my life, but something happened. Something inside of me snapped. And as the police were, talking to me and I was standing there, I knew I couldn't do this anymore. And one of the officers, they hadn't cuffed me yet, and his revolver was, next to me, and I thought to myself, you know, grab the revolver and shoot the cop and flee. And then I thought, no, I get caught, you know, whenever I do anything, grab the revolver and shoot myself. I can't do this anymore. And I don't know if that was just a fleeting alcoholic thought or if it was something I was going to act on, but something internally had changed. They cuffed me before I ever had a chance to act on it, took me in, and gave me one of those rides in the back of a police car where, you know, you're cuffed behind you, and they slam the brakes on, accelerate, slam the brakes on, so your face hits the plexiglass all the way down into the police station. Not that I deserved anything like that, but... anyway, they took me in, and normally, like I said, I was a cop fighter. This night, I just broke down and I started crying. And I was crying in there, and I just crying uncontrollably. They took me home later that night, and my last conscious thought before I passed out was, I wonder if I'll feel this way in the morning. And when I came to in the morning, I did feel that way. I hit a bottom. I could not continue living the way I was living. Had I had a crystal ball that morning that said, if I just drink this way for another 3 months or another 6 months, I'd die, I would have drank until I died. My fear was that I was going to continue to drink like that and live another 6 months or a year or 2 years or 5 or 10 and continue to spiral down this miserable existence of a life that I carved out for myself. And I cried out to a God that I did not want to believe in, and I said, God, please make this stop or kill me. And I became willing to do whatever it was in Alcoholics Anonymous that was asked of me. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I joined that Clay Street group that I'd mentioned. They told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a big book, start reading it, start working the steps, you know, get a sponsor, get a service commitment. And it was a very active group, very step-oriented and book-oriented. And they got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, and I just stopped fighting everything. I had an issue with the Lord's Prayer, but I saw that other people that were staying sober were saying the Lord's Prayer and, you know, holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer, so I held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And there was a guy there that I heard one morning at a morning meeting say, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. And I identified with that, you know, and that guy ended up being my sponsor. And all went well for about 44 days. And at 44 days, I ended up having a panic attack. Now, I never had a panic attack in my life before until I got sober. I had experience with fear and anxiety, but not a panic attack. Ended up in a hospital knowing that I was going crazy. I spent the majority of my early sobriety at nights in a fetal position, knowing that at any moment I was going to be institutionalized, and just trying to pray to a God that I didn't quite yet believe in. The group that I got sober in, by the way, said, don't worry about God. They said, in order to make a start in this program, you don't have to believe in God. You just have to take actions as if you believe in God. And I'm grateful they told me that, because I did. And little by little, I did start to form a relationship with a higher power in my early sobriety. But I had this anxiety attack, and that started this journey of, you know, just this, all that ism that I talked about earlier started bubbling to the surface. I was starting to develop a relationship with a higher power, but I was going crazy at the same time. And I had done the first 3 steps, but I hadn't started writing that 4th step yet. And just to give you guys an idea of how crazy I was, I was about 9 months sober. I took a psychology test or class, and in the psychology class, we took a one of those self-examination type tests, kind of like the MMPI. And it was a stress test. And the professor at the, you know, we self-graded, and at the end the professor said, who here scored between 0 and 25? There was a handful of people that raised their hand. He said, you know, stress bounces off you like, you know, water off a duck. Who here scored between 25 and 50? The majority of the class raises their hand. And he said, you guys process stress normally. Who scored between 50 and 75? There was a handful of people, and he said, you guys have a, you know, major event in your life, like a divorce or a death or a move or something like that. Who scored here between 75 and 100? There's nobody. Who scored between 100 and 125? Nobody. Anybody over 125? Nobody. Except I, you know, kept my hands out of my side. I'd scored 146, and so that concerned me. And and I went down to the professor, who was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, you know, I scored 146 on this test, and And he said, oh, he goes, don't worry about that. Anybody in their first year of sobriety would score, you know, over 125 on this exam. And then he indicated very gently that I should probably get on that fourth step, and which had been indicated many times by my sponsor and other members of the group, but I just hadn't quite heard that yet. And I still didn't do any act on that until about a month later. About a month later, I was coming out of my skin one more time, and I called somebody, and you know, he had shared something that was, I believe, to be counter to what AA preaches, or what, not that AA preaches anything, but you know, that the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hit a bottom. I hit a bottom in sobriety. It's like, my God, I thought I had a solution here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I'm being told by AA members to go out and seek something else besides AA because I was too crazy to get Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made a decision, and that was I was going to do steps 4, and I was going to work steps 4 through 12. And when I got to step 12, if I still felt this way, I was going to commit suicide. And so I started in on that 4-step, and I wrote a thorough 4-step, and I did what my sponsor told me to do. We got together, and I read the 5th step. And about halfway or 2/3 of the way through that 5th step, we took a break, and I went and used the restroom. And one of the things that I'd become in a habit of doing when I wasn't drinking is I would turn to the mirror, and I would evaluate myself. And I would either tear myself down or build myself up. And it would originate somewhere in my soul. You know, I'm worthless, I'm this, I'm, this is what's wrong with me, this is what's wrong with me, this is what's wrong with me. Or I'd say, this is what's right with me, this is what's right with me, you know. And then I'd sink right back down and down, nah, you're really a loser. And I turned to the mirror to do this ritual that I'd been doing for as long as I could remember, and nothing happened. And I looked at my eyes in the mirror, and what's this feeling I'm feeling? And I was trying to identify what it was. And then suddenly I realized what it was, and it was comfort. It was the first time I'd experienced comfort in my own skin without having a certain amount of alcohol in my system to anesthetize my emotions enough to where I could feel comfortable. And, that was my reaction to the 5th step. And 2 weeks later after that, I noticed, you know, that the panic attacks had left. The anxiety, the fear of people started to leave. The hatred towards everybody on this planet started to leave. The self-pity, it started to leave. Not all. I mean, I didn't walk away free from that stuff, but enough of the power was taken away from it where I could go out and function and in life. It was as if something internally had just shifted a little bit, but that little bit made all the difference in the world. And that's what made me a believer in Alcoholics Anonymous. After that, I mean, I had a spiritual experience. It wasn't a burning bush. It wasn't God's voice, but I knew that these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous worked. There's some promises on page 75 right in between steps 5 and 6. And I didn't even know they were there. And that's exactly what happened to me. Those promises started to happen in my life. I went on into steps 8 and 9 because now I was on fire for the program. I went into 8 and 9 and into 10, 11, and 12 and became a participant in Alcoholics Anonymous. Up to that point, I believed that Alcoholics Anonymous would relieve me of the obsession to drink. But after doing that 5th step, I became a believer as Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life, as a design for living. When I was about 2.5 years sober, I had an intuitive thought where all my life I wouldn't participate in anything unless I was sure to win, because I was terrified of being in second place or losing. And I had this intuitive thought as a result of the steps where I realized that those rules apply to normal people. For me, just stepping up into the batter's box and swinging the bat, regardless of the outcome, is success. The only time I fail is not stepping into that batter's box in the first place. And through that intuitive thought, I went out and I got a job as a stockbroker. Now, I was somebody who, my last 2 years, couldn't hold a job for more than 3 weeks, was drinking to oblivion, rested 9 times in that last 12 months. And I became a stockbroker at 2.5 years sober. At 5 years sober, through a series of coincidences, which my wife already touched on a little bit, I ended up, my wife and I always wanted to be with my wife. I met her about 2 years before I got sober, or a year and a half before I got sober. And I always wanted to be with her. And through a surrender, she was in Los Angeles, I was in Portland. And I met her down in Laguna Beach, And I walked away from this Laguna Beach thing knowing that we would never be together because, you know, geographically she was pretty unattractive. And I just knew it wouldn't happen. And I surrendered and I gave it to God for the first time. Now, I wanted to be with her, but I just put the outcome in her hands. And I finally surrendered. The next day she called and expressed her love for me. And we were together a month later. And through Alcoholics Anonymous, I ended up with working for one of the most prestigious investment banks in the country in San Francisco. And I quit because of fear at about 4 years sober. And they had a policy where if you leave this investment bank, you can never come back. And I tried to come back anyway. And they almost let me. And then this guy in New York said, no, can't do it. So I was so disappointed and so forth about this, you know, because I knew I needed to work for this firm, you know. And I ended up starting my own little firm. And I started my own little firm based on the philosophy of this other firm. That other firm that wouldn't hire me back ended up closing their the retail division of their firm, which I was in retail. And about the same time that, which, you know, was a blessing, because had I been there, I would have had to move on and so forth. But at the same time that they closed their retail, I was looking for new office furniture. And I was calling around Portland. I found a warehouse that just bought used furniture for a trading firm, you know, for, you know, trading desks and so forth, which is unique. I mean, it's, you know. And I said, yeah, hold on to those. I'm going to come look at them. I went down there. I bought all the furniture from the office I used to work for in San Francisco. And I put, you know, 40 desks out on the trading floor, and I put one in my office and one in my business partner's office. I went into my office to clean out my desk, and in the desk drawer was the check stub of my mentor at the firm of in San Francisco. The guy that mentored me in the business, I ended up with his desk, you know, just a series of coincidences. And had I gotten what I wanted, it would not have been the best thing for me. But having surrendered and doing, you know, trying to apply this program to my life, I ended up getting something far better than what I would have ever, you know, wanted for myself or strived for myself. When I was about 6 years sober, I ended up little by little, as much as the gifts of this program, and by the way, the gifts of this program for the new people are not working for investment banks or necessarily getting, you know, the right wife. Those are fringe benefits that can and may happen. My benefits are internally, being comfortable in my own skin. But when I was about 6 years sober, very subtly, I got away from doing Alcoholics Anonymous. Little by little by little by little. And it was so subtle that I could never even see it happening. And the cunning, baffling, powerful part of that journey was my life still went well for a while. And finally, after about a year of that, my life crashed and I became as sick as I was in those first 90 days of sobriety. I was full of depression. I gained about 25 pounds, maybe 30. I was having anxiety attacks. My fear of people was back. The resentment towards everybody was back. I was keeping secrets and I was sick. And I kept saying to myself over and over, what's wrong with me? At 7 years sober, I'm not supposed to feel this way. And thinking that there's another solution. And once again, one thing I never stopped doing is I never stopped praying and meditating or reading the big book. I just wasn't going to meetings. I wasn't helping people. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing any of the others, taking inventory and all that kind of stuff. But I had a kind of a moment of clarity. And that was, I thought to myself, that was new. The basics of this program got me through this. My next thought was, but I've got 7 years. I shouldn't have to do the basics of this program to get through this. And then that moment of clarity. Wait a minute. Maybe this is where people end up going down a path where they ultimately end up drinking or committing suicide. You know. And so I re-entrenched my life back in Alcoholics Anonymous. I re-immersed my life back in the principles. I got a new sponsor, started working through the steps. And I thought that after like 2 or 3 weeks of going to meetings and doing a little bit of this, I'd be right back to where I once was emotionally and spiritually. And I wasn't. It took a full year of work and carrying the message. One of the things I did, I started taking a meeting into a detox. I started sponsoring all these crazy guys and really just doing all the basic stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And after about 10 months or so, I started getting relief from that. And by the time I was about a year away from that dry period, I ended up being back and ultimately getting better. My life today is, I live a wonderful life. And as long as I put Alcoholics Anonymous first, and it is my priority in life, I tend to do pretty well out there. I suffer from alcoholism very badly, though. I'm somebody that, I have two choices. A certain amount of alcohol in my system will give me relief, or a certain amount of Alcoholics Anonymous will get me relief. But I can't sit in the middle. I have to do one or the other. As my wife said, I believe that alcohol actually preserved my sanity. And I have to have my sanity preserved, either through the actions of this program or through some sort of anesthetizing these emotions in the ism through alcohol. My wife, and I'm going to close with just this, the way that Alcoholics Anonymous is still working in my life and in my family's life, is about a year ago, I was speaking at a meeting, and I just gave a horrible talk. It's the worst talk I've ever given in my life, and until tonight. but it was terrible. I mean, it was just horrible. But afterwards, in the thank you line, this girl came up to me, and she said, thank you so much, blah, 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 and she goes, what other meetings do you go to? And I told her the meetings I went to, anyway, she ended up in that meeting, and she ended up asking my wife to be her sponsor. And she disclosed that she was on her way to commit suicide that night. And she was dry in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She had gotten away from AA. And she was on her way to commit suicide, and a friend of hers had said, you want to go and hear this guy, and, go hear him talk tonight, and got her to come to this meeting. And something I said, like I said, I did a horrible job, but something that I said struck her, and she came back and asked her to be her sponsor. Now, fast forwarding, about 10 months after that, my wife was diagnosed with, so this is 2 years ago, I guess, my wife was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and she walked through that with her sponsor, and we walked through that as a family, and this girl, Celine, who was on her way to commit suicide, fast forwarding about another 10 months, she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And as a result of, as a result of suiting up and showing up and trying to do my best to carry the message, even though it was a very poor job of doing it, someone else heard the message and through a series of coincidences ended up with a sponsor who walked through a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis 10 months prior to her. So, I'm a believer in Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I'm some sort of joiner who, becomes a pitch man for anything he joins. I'm a skeptic by nature. I love Alcoholics Anonymous because of what it's done for me. And just in closing, I'd just like to close with something that Chuck Chamberlain used to say, which is true for me today, and that is, today I've got two choices. I can live a self-centered life and suffer the consequences, or I can live a God-centered life and suffer the consequences. Thanks.
At this time, I'd like to turn the meeting over to the secretary.
Mr. Alcoholics Secretary, and I would like to thank all the participants in tonight's meeting, and I would like to give a very special thank you to Christopher for sharing. Welcome to the newcomers who are with us tonight. We invite you to make this one of your regular meetings. We have AA literature. Well, tonight we don't have AA's literature, but normally we have it over here on the table to my right. We make CDs and tapes of our speakers. Please see Scott if you would like a copy of tonight's speaker. George is in the back, who is our grapevine representative. Thank you, George. We do sign court cards at this meeting. Please see either myself or the leader. If you have placed your court card in the basket, it has been signed and is in the basket over there to my left. This group celebrates birthdays of people who attend regularly. If you would like to celebrate your birthday with us, please see Dean, who is normally here. He is a birthday person. A birthday consists of 365 days of continuous sobriety, free from the use of alcohol. Tonight we have three birthdays. We ask that you limit your sharing to no more than 2 minutes. And our first birthday is for Shelley B. for 2 years.
Cheryl M. for giving my cake and guiding me through the steps this year. And this is my home group, and my sobriety date is August 5th, 2005. And I wanted to thank my higher power and everybody here and everyone that's given me rides and all the women in the program for helping me. Thank you.
Second birthday tonight is for Gail G. for 18 years.
And I'm an alcoholic, and I'm alive, sane, and sober, and it wasn't always that way. To those of you that are new, those that are fairly new, and those that are not so new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks for teaching me to read the book, work the steps, call my sponsor, and to give it away. You know, to do the do, and you'll get the get. And as a result of calling AA in a blackout on August 9th, 1989. I haven't wet the bed in 18 years.
And our third birthday tonight is for Airplane Don.
Tonight, safe, sane, and sober ain't bad. 2 out of 3. Thanks.
It takes a lot of people to keep this meeting going. I would like to thank those who come early to set up and those who stay late to clean up. I need 4 volunteers who will actually stay to help clean up. I have 1 volunteer, 2 volunteers. 3. I need 4 volunteers. Thank you. 4 volunteers. Okay. Would the smokers please pick up your cigarette butts and place them in the containers provided out front? We need to be responsible if we are to keep our meeting place. We ask that you take your cups and trash and put them in the containers in the back of the room. Light colored chairs go on the rack to the left. Dark colored chairs go on the rack underneath the stage. And I would like to thank David for leaving a great meeting. Thank you.
I would like to thank all the participants in tonight's meeting. Christian for Chapter 5, Barbara for the first 10-minute talk, Don for the second 10-minute talk, Sayona for the 12 traditions, and Christopher for a five-man talk. I would also like to wish happy birthday to the birthday people. This has been a regular meeting of the Casablanca Interaction Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are cordially invited to meet with us again soon and to become a regular member of our group. All the participants next week will be sober alcoholics. There are approximately 900 meetings in the Riverside-San Bernardino area. We suggest you attend as many as possible and hope you will join us again soon. We will close this meeting in our usual manner by saying the Lord's Prayer. Tonight I would like to ask Robert to lead us after a moment of silent meditation for the alcoholic who still suffers.